This is a conversation between Carl Hubbell and Walter Langford on June 15th, 1982, in Scottsdale, Arizona. Let's talk about the screwball first, Carl. How'd you chance upon that pitch?
Well, by accident, of course, and everything. I played part of 2 years in a low class D league there in Oklahoma, and Oklahoma City was in the Western League, which was a good A league at the time. Yeah. You know, older players played. You know, then it was no farm system, no nothing. You know,
that's right.
Major league clubs, all independent clubs, and minor leagues, and they bought their players from the minor leagues, and so forth and so on. And so I went to well, in fact, the league, the little Class D league, they blowed up before the end of the season, and I guess that owner over there called up over there, and that manager, I mean, knew if look was any young players over there, you know, if it looked like there might be a prospect of some kind, and evidently he said he, you know, he picked me out and said I was the youngest player on the club, and so it was. The last 30 days of the season, they can bring players up, you know, and then it wasn't quite that time, so the owner called me and told me, you know, that let him know where I was, be at home, why he'd call me, and the last 30 days of the season, why he'd take me over to Oklahoma City and give me a contract. So I got over there, and I was all eyes and everything else, you know, just getting up there.
Sure.
And I think probably one of the most fortunate things in my life was the fact that there was an old left-hand pitcher on the ball club, the name of Lefty Thomas. That he had been up for a cup of coffee several times, you know, in the big leagues, but didn't quite make it, but really knew how to pitch and everything, you know.
Yeah.
And for some reason or other, he just attracted me. He's the only one I looked at. There was others that threw harder and everything else and all wilder.
But he knew more.
Well, he made pitching look easy. And he had a kind of a sinking fastball, you know. And, of course, right-hand hitters, they like to really tee off on the left-hander, especially when they get him in the hole. No, he's got to
come
in
there with it, yeah.
And he, you go out there and just get him a run or two on, you know, nobody out, and he just throw that sinker right out there on that outside corner, and about a three hopper, the shortstop, boom, boom, he'd walk off, didn't even break a sweat or anything, you know.
Gee whiz.
And boy, I mean, it just enthralled me, you know, to that. I guess I had instincts of knowing that, you know, because I was real young, nearly at high school, and to know, you know, that
he was the
that
one.
Was the one, yeah. Right there. So I got to pitch a couple of games. I won one and lost one for the season. That season was over. But all winter long, I was, you know, I'd be thinking about going spring training next year, you know, and I'm going to work on getting that, turning that ball over and getting that sinker and everything else.
Where were you living then, Carl?
I was living in Oklahoma, about 35 miles east of Oklahoma City, was where I was raised.
Yeah.
And I couldn't wait for spring training to start that next year. And we went down in Texas to train down there at Weatherford. And man, I got right in, you know. I was getting out there and I was turning that thing over. And I turned it over pretty good. I had a pretty good sinker, but they wanted me to try to get a change of pace, you know. So I turned it good off of my fastball, you know, somewhere or other. And I fortunately I had pretty flexible, you know, joints, wrists, you know, the
that helps.
Lateral, yes. It does on the screwball, I think, for sure.
Yeah.
And I get to going along with it, and found out that the more I turn it over, the more I come up and over,
mm-hmm.
and turning it, well, I could get a much better brake on it, you see.
Sure.
And of course, the more brake, the more spin you get on the ball, and the more brake,
right.
Well, the slower it gets, you know, it slows it up.
Yes.
So, I come up, when I threw the screwball, I come right up over the top, and I turned my arm clear over and let the ball come out of the back of my hand. That's exactly the way I threw it.
Wow.
And you know, everybody say, oh, geez, you're going to tear your arm up throwing a ball like that. And the amazing thing about it, but in 30, we were trained 30 days, and I could get that over the plate just as well as I could my fastball.
Oh, I got it.
And just come right up and just turn it over and let it come right out of the back of the hand. And that slowed it up tremendously.
But
the real effectiveness of the screwball wasn't the break at all. It's the speed of the ball.
Right?
I thought exactly like my fastball.
Yeah.
You see. And hitters, that's all they look for. They look for this last, you know, this.
Mm-hmm.
And if you come right over there and just a man like that, Stu Miller was the greatest example of it in the world. I don't know if you ever saw him or not.
I never saw him pitch, no.
Well, he never had a fastball at all, and he stayed in the big leagues for 15 years.
Couldn't break a pain.
But he could throw a changeup off of a changeup. And he could with the same motion.
That's what counts.
And that's just...
Yeah.
Frank Howard, I'm telling you, I thought, you know, the biggest...
Well,
Stu, I thought he was going to go out there and just pinch his head off. I'm telling you, the most frustrated human being I ever saw with a bat. And he could not even foul the ball. And Stu could do it. Well, mine was was the same. It's the same thing. And I could just come right over and get the same motion, and just like I'm going to throw them. I did have a fairly good fastball, you know.
Yeah.
And that was made the effectiveness
sure.
of the screwball.
All the more.
Because that exactly was the same motion.
Yeah.
And a hitter, those hitters, they've got to have all that in their mind, you know. Emotion and everything else, and in order to, and they got to protect themselves against the fastball, see, because they always, a hitter always feels like it. They can, if they're looking for the fastball, they can always adjust and hit the slower stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So they've got to protect themselves against the fastball.
That's right.
So, That's what made the effectiveness, screwball so effective,
sure.
was the fact that it was all with the same motion. Then I also had a pretty good curveball too,
mm-hmm.
and that's how I developed the screwball. Now I didn't know what it was, the catcher, you know. You didn't know what it was. It had come to be called a screwball. Why, when we got up to Oklahoma City, we just had a young catcher there. He was about as young as I was. But the owner got an old minor league catcher, you know, just about before the season opened. And he'd been around a long time. So... I was warming up one day there with him, and just as we got there, and I threw a fastball in the curve, and then I told him, you know, this. And so I wound up and I threw him a screwball, and he says, throw that thing again. I threw it again, and he said, well, that's the scariest damn pitch I ever saw.
And that's how I got his name.
Hence the screwball.
That's great.
It was in. And so then, I went on then and pitched for Oakland City that year. I won 18 games. I never lost night or something like that. Hell, I was sold to Detroit.
Oh, I didn't know.
Yeah, and that's just an A-League, you know. They generally put all the clubs from the International American Association, the Coast League.
That's right.
I was sold to Detroit. Sold to Detroit. And, you talk about somebody on up in the clouds. And I couldn't wait till next spring, you know, so I went to training with Detroit. Ty Cobb was the manager then.
What was that, about 26 or 7?
26.
Yeah.
In Augusta, Georgia, and because Ty never said a word to me at any time during the training. George McBride was his number one guy that handled all the younger guys and everything else, and I started throwing the screwball, you know, and then he said, what are you doing now? And I said, well, that's a screwball. He said, oh, I said, you're going to tear your arm up. I said, don't throw that. Well, naturally, you're not, you know, you're going to, whatever they say.
Yeah, at that age.
Stand on my head and try to throw while I would have done the same thing. Mm-hmm. But, so I gave it up. But there was other things. I don't know. I never did figure it out. I think I figured it out later on. I never pitched one inning of an exhibition game for Detroit in 3 years.
Three years
they held on to me, and I never. I pitched batting practice all the same time, and they held on to me.
You stayed with the club all season each year.
Well, they informed me out. I broke through the organization.
Yeah.
You know, but just kept sending me out.
Hmm. Where did they send you to?
Oh hell, I was all over. Those 3 years, I was all over. I was in. Well, first they sent me to Toronto. See, the big league club then had the top minor league club.
Yeah.
Because they buy players and they're not quite ready for the big leagues. They always had, the Giants had Jersey City and Detroit had Toronto, and they all had, Yankees had Newark.
Newark,
four,
exactly.
To, you know, get them
Tony
ready
had
for,
Baltimore,
for the big club. So they sent me over to, Toronto. And Dan Halley was over there, and they just built a new park. See, Toronto, they used to play out on an island out there, where they had a
fair or exhibition.
Well, that's where they had all things like that, you know. But there was no bridge going over there. You had to take a ferry over. So they had built a one on the mainland, a brand new park, and they sure wanted to get a good club together, which it did. They had a bunch of old players and everything else, and I was optioned over there, and I put me in the bullpen, you know, and things like that. I never did start a game for them. I was in the bullpen. Now, I want to establish something with you now. I've heard a lot of old ball players talking about, you know, and they tell great stories, and you know they were stretching things, you know, and everything else. But whatever I tell you, I mean, that's it.
That's it.
It's it.
That's what I like. Tom.
Yeah. So, I was in the bullpen all the time. So that year, Washington had won the pennant that year and beat the Yankees out. So they had arranged on one of the days of traveling back and forth east-west to stop off in Toronto to play an exhibition game, you know, to get, you know, to help on the stadium and everything else. So I think Washington was the first one that came in there. And we were in first place, and Halley had all of his starting pitchers. He didn't want to break it up, so they're going to throw me into the Lions, you know, and everything else. And Steve O'Neill was an old American League catcher, you know, and everything else, you know.
Yeah.
And I had no screwballs, no nothing or anything else, you see. I was told, you know, not to over there. But I... I talked to Steve, you know, before. They go up, you know, for me, I was going to pitch and start the game.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I'd like to just try this thing out, you know, on the summer. You know, things. Mm-hmm. Well, sure, we will.
And was Steve your manager?
No, Bet Dan Halley was the manager. Steve was just the old catcher there, you know.
All right.
And Washington, I came in there first, I think, and they were the world champion. I think they beat Pittsburgh that year.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And, and I hadn't pitched over 3 or 4 innings at any given time up to this time, just the middle of the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And we just wound up, we beat Washington 5-4.
Oh,
and I pitched the whole damn game.
Great.
Now then, Babe Ruth and Gehrig and all of them come in, you know, the next time. So, you know, they throw me in there again. And we just wind up beating 5-1. Now, this is the truth. I had those box scores for a long time.
I
wish the hell that I...
You should have kept them.
So, yeah, I know, but I mean, as much as I moved and everything else...
Yeah, you can't keep everything.
There, no.
They get lost.
But I did have those box scores. But... Anyway, that's the truth. Wouldn't you have thought that that would rung a bell up in Detroit somewhere?
Sure as hell would.
Not and nothing.
I can't imagine it.
They did.
Who was their general manager? Doesn't matter.
Well, Jack Zeller, I think, had the most to do with bringing the players up and sending them out. Jack Zeller.
But hell, you think the manager too would know which players down in the minors they had a contract with and would be watching.
Well, you would, yeah. Of course, Navin, Frank Navin, he was like Bob Lurie does, you know, he had someone, you know, to run the ball club, and he wasn't active in, you know, in the operation of the club. He owned the club and everything else, but he wasn't active. And so I don't know just who was in the office. Well, somebody, like I say, it should have rung a bell somewhere. Anyway, it didn't. And the second year, now after that year, I don't know, I read up there all year, and I had a record of something like 9-7 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I've never pitched a lot. Anyway, the next year, they opened me out before they went to spring training.
Mm.
I didn't even go to spring training.
True.
And then the last year, though, of course, would be the last year, 3 years of options. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So I went to spring training with them, and that old umpire that... was in the American League there, I'll think of his name in a minute.
Billy Evans?
No. He just managed him 2 years and then he was out. He was impossible.
Who, the Tigers?
Yeah. And,
after Cobb?
Yeah, 27 and 28.
I'll get it for you.
I could think of it.
George Moriarty.
Moriarty. He was something else as a manager. I didn't know too much about him, but I could hear the rest of the guy really moaning about it. But anyway, hell, I never got into a ball game or nothing. And then I was sent out to Beaumont, which Texas.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only club, I guess, that wanted me after being there 3 years, you know. Hell, nobody wanted. I should have had a reject, you know, written over my uniform because that's what I was. And I didn't expect a scout or nobody would ever come around to, and then make it in what kind of year you're having, because they say, hell, Detroit had him for 3 years and
never used him a minute.
And hell, if he couldn't help them, he sure in hell he's not going to help us. And here is, you're going to, begin to think sooner or later that I'm making up things, because it's weird things that I tell you you could hardly believe.
Yeah.
There were two old ball players there in Texas League. They were trying to make it go over Beaumont. They had, you know, Texas League was a pretty good A League.
It sure was. Right.
And they had some good towns, good teams in them.
That's where I was raised, and that's where I really got interested in baseball.
Well, then you know about it. And they'd take anybody. I mean, anybody that they had to offer, they'd get them. Well, I went down, and I, right there, the only time that I just questioning myself, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
you'd have to.
What in the world are you doing? You did. But I had what I'd done when I was out of high school. I'd worked 2 years in the oil field, see, before, and I was oil field team in Oklahoma. Had a baseball team, and that before I went into the Class D League. So I can get me. I can always go back to that.
Get
so
a job,
I can,
yeah.
Well, I can always. They had baseball teams, and you can always do that. And I know one thing, that if I do quit, I'll blame myself the rest of my life.
That's right.
I'll just live the rest of my life blaming myself for it. Damn it, I'm going to stick it out somewhere with it and see if I can possibly get a chance. I didn't know whether I could pitch in the big leagues or not.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, I knew one thing about pitching against those hitters. And there's one thing about hitters. They may not hustle out there running the bases, but they like to swing a bat. Like to hit that
That's
ball.
Right.
I realized that, and I said I had done pretty well with that. And I know I may never get a chance, but I'll stick it out. So we were in last place, and Houston was in first place. I'm going to use the word, it just so happened so many times that you'll know that I'm telling a lie or something. The only scout that the Giants had was Dick Kinsella.
Yeah, I know.
Old guy, he was from, he was a politician in Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
Lived in Springfield, where the capital was there, you know, but he was a dear friend of John McGraw's, and was about as old as John McGraw, you know, and
might have
known him from way back. And he was the only scout the Giants had.
Hmm.
And he would go every time he'd go out here about some in, mostly were in the AAA, or his AA then. But, and he'd have him go look at it, see. Dick Kinsella was a Democratic delegate to the Democratic Party, which was in Houston, Texas in 1928.
Mm-hmm. Nominated Al Smith.
Right. And I it just so happened that Beaumont was playing in Houston, and it was all day baseball games then.
Oh,
know.
Yeah, sure.
But happened to be playing in Houston at that mm-hmm. time.
That's the old accident of being in the right place at the right time, finally.
And it just happened that Dick Kinsella was a delegate to the Democratic Convention.
Mm-hmm.
And it just so happened that one afternoon there wasn't a damn thing going on in there, and he says, hell, I'll amble out to the ball game and sit out there and watch the ball game. That's the time. So happened that I was pitching that day. Pitching against Bill Hallahan. You remember Bill?
Was a Wild
good,
Bill.
Damn good pitcher.
Yeah.
And so we got tied up in the one out there. And I think it's tied at 1-1 at the ninth inning, the best I remember. And we went in, I guess about the 11th inning, we scored a run,
mm-hmm.
and we beat him 2-1. And then this is Dick Kinsella's story from here on. I just read that in the paper. I didn't know anything about it. He took and hurried to the phone and said, well, he called John McGraw. He said, hell, I saw another Herb, what's that left-hand pitcher, Herb?
Pinnock?
No, just in the early 20s when they were beating the Yankees, Herb.
Melton?
Herb, hell.
We'll get it.
Well, I could think of it in a little bit.
Yeah.
Well,
Art Neff wrote
Neff.
Art Neff.
Yeah. If I'd have thought of the word Art, then I would have done it. Art Neff. Just saw another Art Neff picture today.
That's pretty high praise.
Yeah, it was. And the girl got all excited. He said, you want to know who and where and is he available and everything else? And then he told him, well, I don't know. He said, no, he's been with Detroit 3 years and they've sent him down here to Beaumont. So he said, he must be available. But he said, I don't. But McGraw told him, well, forget about that damn convention and you get over there to Beaumont and find out about everything. And my God, within about 3 or 4 days, I was on my way to join the Giants in Chicago.
That's
the damn truth.
Boy.
Everything. Ever better.
It's a story that...
Nobody will believe it. I mean,
yeah, sure. I believe it perfectly
you know,
well.
You're the only person I ever told that to.
Oh, no.
All your writers in New York and everywhere else, you know, they have a life story. I said, no, my life story. I said, hell, I never... The only thing I ever done growing up, I worked on the damn farm and went to school. That's all I hell around where I lived. And it was the damn truth. Where I lived, there was no place to go swimming, to go fishing, to go or nothing.
Yeah.
You just work on the farm and go to school.
Yeah.
And I said, the hell with it.
That's right.
The story of my life has never been told. It never will be told.
Not all of it, though.
So let me
ask you this. Obviously, the screwball helped make your great career.
Oh yeah,
make your career great. But at the same time, and it didn't wreck your arm right away like the guys were warning you at first. But it must have put an awful strain on it, huh?
The only thing it bothered in my arm was this. You see, it's crooked and everything else, and of course. I never had an ache or a pain in my shoulder, in a ligament or a muscle or nothing.
Just around the elbow there.
Just a calcium deposit. This pounding, whenever you throw, you get a hell of a pounding.
You sure do.
And nature starts putting protective. In there, you know, something to protect it.
Mm-hmm.
And they get in those, thickening in there, you know, and then in the inside of that thickening, they'll start adding some calcium in there, you see.
They didn't have doctors in those days
that
knew how to do that.
They didn't have a trainer that knew the first damn thing about even training anything. They could rub you down, and that's the only damn thing that they did. Nobody until Bob Curlin come along knew anything about cutting on an arm.
Mm-hmm.
He did know it, and he's got a guy now, Joe, that can do same thing, too. If you want to know,
over in L.A.
they've done wonders with, cutting on arms.
Oh, bringing back people like Tommy John and others.
You can't believe that.
No, that's right.
Absolutely. And he's a better pitcher now than he ever was when he had a good arm.
Absolutely. Which is most amazing.
It is.
Well, I read somewhere not too long ago that you were quoted as saying that... after every game you pitched, you would have such a pain in the arm overnight that you didn't know whether you were going to die before morning.
That wasn't me. That wasn't me, Tom.
Somebody just putting those words in your mouth.
Naturally, that you know this thing is going. You get a little. You know it's. You know. You feel it. But hell, you can feel throw with a bad elbow. But if you get anything wrong up here, you can't.
You've got
you
trouble.
Think you're going to find the ball, but you're not. You can't do it.
That's right.
No way in the world you can do it. And I never had an ache or a pain in my arm at all. He took 17 pieces. Actually, my arm started crooking up.
Yeah.
In 1934, that's 6 years after I had gotten to join the Giants. Started crooking up. And if I had had that done then, like a doctor like Curlin, well, I could just fix it up and I could have gone right on. Hell,
you still went for a good while there.
But not
at the same pace.
A half a pitcher. I went 11, 12 games a year.
Yeah, that's right.
All I could do.
After 37.
Right.
Now, Wasn't the screwball Sandy Koufax's best pitch?
No.
No? What was his?
No. Oh, God damn, he just had that right fastball and a curveball that absolutely,
just
you talk about
off,
rolling off the table. Yeah. It rolled off the table.
That's what it took. Those two.
Hell, the amazing thing about Koufax is that the Dodgers held on to him for six years before he could ever pitch. Before he could ever pitch. He was in Brooklyn for a long time.
I know it.
Before he could get the, hell, they just kept, but they held on to him, and I'll tell you, it paid off. For 4 years, he was the best pitcher I ever saw in my life.
Oh, yes.
Four years, but just about 4 years, the best pitcher I ever saw.
I think most people would agree on that. Now, who are some of the others who have mastered the screwball up to Fernando?
Nobody ever mastered it.
Mm-hmm.
What they do, they throw them. I mean, Warren Spahn come up with a pretty good one, and Marshall, that relief pitcher, you know, had a pretty good one. But they don't turn their arm over. They come out here and they slide it out. Slide it out right here, see.
Uh-huh.
They don't come up and over and get it out of the back of their hand.
How did Stu Miller throw it?
Well, he didn't throw a screwball.
He didn't have a screwball.
He just had those. Change of pace.
Change of pace off of a change of pace.
Yeah, just one right after another. All kinds of
things. So now, does Fernando throw with turning his arm as you did?
It's hard for me to tell. You nearly got to get that in slow motion.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
He comes right up over the top.
Just he does. Yeah.
Oh, you know how? And he spins and he comes right up over the top. And. But unless you get in slow motion, you wouldn't be able to tell. You can't tell.
Well, the guy that's supposed to have taught it to him, Bobby Castillo, he apparently threw something in the way of a
screwball.
Well,
he did, but he threw one of these. I guess the way Venezuela came up with it, he can move overhanded, you see. You couldn't turn your arm. You could, you know, it'd be awful hard right here, and then you're going to turn. You don't know where the ball would go.
You'd be a contortionist.
Yes, you sure would. But his motion is good, you know, to come right up and over and come right down with it that way. Motion very good.
If he had a faster fastball,
oh God,
it'd be murder.
You wouldn't beat him.
Yep.
You wouldn't beat him.
Yeah, this is fast, pretty fast, but it's not a Koufax fastball.
Oh, hell no.
Hold on. Well, how was your fastball?
Oh, I would say, just judging everything is, well, or maybe a little less than 90, probably from 88 to 90, something like that.
Plenty good, Carl. When you
with the other stuff
I had, it would.
If I didn't have the other stuff, it wouldn't have been.
I guess that's sure right.
But it went together well because it was effective.
Tell me a little about John McGraw.
I can tell you a lot about it.
I'm sure you could.
And it's a story that I've never told, but he's a legend in baseball, you know.
Right.
And it's, you know, a lot of people are going to say, well, here's an old left-hand pitcher that you're talking about a legend in baseball. And I'll tell you, he was something.
He had to be.
He played that little Napoleon bit to the very hilt. I mean, that was his life.
Yeah.
His life.
Yeah.
He lived it. He lived it. He must dream it. He must have done everything.
Yeah.
The little Napoleon.
Yeah.
And... see who were I learned. I mean, I couldn't understand it. I didn't know what I was going to do. Geez, I'd had such a bad experience in Detroit, and then finally he gave me a chance to pitch in the big leagues, and I appreciated that a hell of a lot. But he called every pitch. See. And every pitch was a breaking ball, be it a curveball or a screwball. He didn't think he had sense enough to throw a fastball, you see. He must have been the worst curveball hitter in the world, because that's why he wanted you to every pitch he throw. The only pitcher that he would allow to pitch his own game was Christy Mathewson. And the only reason for that was because he was the only college graduate pitching in the big leagues at that time.
That's right.
And he let him pitch his own game, and he'd win 30 or 35 games a year. But nobody else. He's got to call on. I'm telling you, just out there, and he's just on. And, you know, I know it's going to just break my arm. He's got to go. Hell, you can't do that. Mm-hmm. And I didn't. He gave me a chance to pitch, you know.
That's right.
I didn't want to say anything, but I'm 4 years with him, and I'm telling you, it's one of my masters along the deal. It really was.
Yeah, he had 28, 29, 30, 31, and then he quit in 32.
Middle of the year in 32.
Yeah.
Terry took over. Well, there's so many other things, I mean, about him,
mm-hmm.
that, see, I can understand you could Bresnahan,
yeah,
the old catcher, was a coach when I went when I joined the club up there, mm-hmm. you see. And finally I got on the train with him or something, and I got to start asking him about John McGraw, how he could be like he is. Well, he says, you don't understand how it was whenever he started managing before the turn of the century. You see, mm-hmm. in Baltimore.
Yeah.
Baltimore was in the...
They had a hell of a team in those years, too.
Yes, but they transferred that to New York,
mm-hmm.
in 1903.
Yeah.
And McGraw went right with it, you see.
Yeah.
He said in those days, a regular player made about $2,500 a year.
Yeah.
And a star like Matheson would make probably 5,000, but there wasn't but one Matheson.
That's right.
And he said, hell, they couldn't stay in a decent hotel. They'd get drunk and they'd just turn things up.
Yeah, they wouldn't be allowed in.
Oh, yeah. Hotels, right. they had to stay in the rooming houses down by the railroad tracks, see? So that's what he had to start with and had to go with for well up into the 1900s, you see, till the World War I.
That's about it.
That was a turning point of that era. And but then Ruth came along and everybody else, and the salaries went up, and the college players started coming into, you know, they could afford now. Fresh, hell, they signed him right out of
Fordham. Right out of Fordham,
But McGraw did not change.
He was still the same old McGraw till the day he left the field.
He was the little Napoleon.
Yeah.
Right straight on through. Well, hell, his guys there, Fresh quit and went home on him. And told him what he could do with the ball club. And that's when he traded him for Hornsby.
I can't imagine McGraw and Hornsby getting on.
Well, they lasted till the end of the season was all. That was during the season that they made the trade. And end of the season, Hornsby went to Boston.
Yeah.
Went to Boston, that's all. Burley Grimes, my God. He's in Burley. Wow. Oh, my God. He quit. He said, hell, he would never pitch another ball for him. And he traded Burley Grimes to 1928. To Pittsburgh for Aldridge.
Vic Aldridge.
Vic Aldridge was strictly, that's all he threw was Curtis. So,
mm-hmm.
You know,
well,
that's super.
Yeah.
Well, that 1928, Burley Grimes won 25 games and Aldridge won 11 for the Giants. And some of the trades that he made, but
well, Burley was a great competitor.
Oh, yeah, they had, of course, hell, McGraw had Hack Wilson there, you know, and he was just running McGraw crazy, you know, and he left him out in the draft. He was drafted for $7,500, the Cubs drafted him.
Yeah.
And, you know, had a hell of a year, I think, Toledo or somewhere. And he'd had a good year for the Giants there.
Yes.
But he just left him out. He didn't want him, and then the Cubs drafted him for $7,500.
That's what you call cutting off your nose to spite your face.
One more minute I might say about McGraw and Little Napoleon. He had the news media so calm, this Little Napoleon man. After every game, this Preston is telling me this. After every game, see, he had his little office at the Polo Grounds, and then he had a room there for nobody interviewed McGraw. Nobody. No Ryan, nobody. After every game, the Bozeman Bulger. I don't know if you remember the old writer there or not.
What's the name again?
Bulger, B-U-L-G-E-R, Bozeman Bulger.
That's right.
He's about as old as McGraw. He could come in after every game and McGraw, nobody said a word. McGraw would write out everything that happened in the ball game, you know, right here. And every one of them was. If he won the ball game, it was something he'd done. If he lost the ball game, it was some dumb damn ball player who made mistakes or some bad pitches or something. And Bulger would take it out. All the rest of them were in another room. He'd say, well, fellas, here's McGraw's report.
Good.
And they wrote their stories.
Story that way.
Now that's how you had them gone.
Boy, he really did. Now, when Terry took over, what kind of a leader was Terry?
Terry was a real good baseball manager in that. And when he took over, just perfect for ball manager. You know, of course, he'd been through the McGraw bit and everything else.
Yeah.
And just perfect. And in the following years when we won the pennant in the World Series,
that's what I was going to say.
We didn't have, all we had good pitching and good defense. Art Terry is the only good hitters we had. But
Terry took a sixth place team from McGraw and brought it into the pennant next year.
They were picked by majority of riders that finish in second or fifth place in the league that year.
Mm-hmm.
So we were actually one of them pitching and defense. Terry was good. Now, of course, Terry's still living in
down in Florida.
Yeah, Jacksonville. And he done a little something for Terry's ego. That World Championship and all that.
Yeah.
It sure did. And he got kind of a little bit uppity in his managing and everything else, you know.
Yeah.
He did.
Well,
I hate to say it about
that's
it because
too bad,
he was so, you know, perfect and everything else at first, but at the dinner, if you remember the dinner that year in New York City, in the winter meetings, and at the tables, you know, when they're writing, Max Carey was manager of the Dodgers.
Yeah.
And some of the writers said, asked Terry something about, or they're discussing baseball and everything else, and said, asked Terry something about Brooklyn. He says, oh, is Brooklyn still in the league? Remember that? Oh, yeah, my God.
Famous last words.
Oh, boy, he lived to regret that.
They
really gave him those.
Max had his revenge.
He sure did.
Actually, in 34, Casey had taken over as manager of Brooklyn.
Well, was it Casey?
Yeah.
Well,
I don't think it was Casey that said that.
No. Well, it was Max Carey, but Max Carey, they were just sitting at a table, you know, having a few drinks, and they were just talking baseball.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way
right.
it was.
Yeah.
Anyway, but I'm sure it was Max
it
Carey.
Came back to haunt him.
Yeah.
Now, you were still there when Mel Ott managed.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well,
how about Mel as a manager?
Mel was too good a guy. Too good a guy to manage. And Horace had quite a bit of influence on him, you know, as far as the players are concerned. Horace is one of the nicest guys in the world. And Horace was a baseball fan. And a baseball fan has likes and dislikes.
That's
exactly that's the only fault that Horace Stoneham had. He just, goddamn, he was just too much of a baseball fan to ever run a big league baseball club. That was his fault.
Yeah. I think there's a few others like that.
You know, more or less. Yeah.